Good afternoon. I'm Kurt Dewhurst. I'm the director of the Center for Great Lakes Culture, and I really want to welcome you today to this presentation, which we're very pleased about because it's part of a partnership that we've established with the Center for Great Lakes Culture and the library to present in the University Library Colloquia series a couple of presentations each year by the fellows who in our fellowship program for the Center for Great Lakes Culture. And I might mention just before we get started and introduce the fellow for 2001 that we have awarded a fellowship for MSU faculty member for 2002, and conveniently she's here. Susan Applegate Krause is the new 2002 Center for Great Lakes Center MSU fellow for the coming year, so we can look forward to Susan's presentation sometime in this series. I did want to say to you, if you don't know much about the Center for Great Lakes Culture, I have some brochures. I'll leave them out here. We also have some flyers for other University Libraries Colloquia Series events, as well as some for a series of regular brown bag talks that we do at the MSU Museum from our program called Our Daily Work, Our Daily Lives. If you're interested in issues related to workers' culture, I think you'll find that series very interesting. It's a noontime event on most Mondays, so I hope you'll pick up one of those green flyers as well before you leave. I did want to also say that we're very pleased today, though, to have our first MSU faculty fellow presentation, because we had in the fall where the Center for Great Lakes Culture gives two fellowships each year, one for a fellowship from someone outside of MSU to come and do work here at MSU, and Francesco Melfi was here in the fall, and we were very pleased to have him here. He gave a lecture. And now Javier Pescador. Dr. Pescador is an assistant professor of history here at MSU, and his project his proposal is very much connected to his talk, of course, today. The original project was entitled Playing in America, Organized Sports and Mexican Latino Communities in the Great Lakes Region, 1940 to 2001. I think his title for today is actually a little more engaging and present and appealing for you, perhaps. But nonetheless, it's an expansion of that. And we're very pleased. Some of you may know that Dr. Pescador was involved in an exhibition that was done working with students in his class that was right at the end of fall semester. And some of you had a chance to see some of those photographs, really wonderful photographs of documentation. And I'm very pleased to announce that the Center for Great Lakes Culture, working with the MSU Museum, we're now producing that as a traveling exhibition, which will tour in the Great Lakes region. So we're very, very pleased about that. So it's my pleasure in introducing to you today Dr. Pescador. Please join me in welcoming him.
I'm going to talk today about the relationship between soccer community formation and the creation of Mexican barrios in the Great Lakes area. So my paper analyzes the impact of organized sports on Mexican communities in Detroit and Chicago between 1940 and 1970. I challenge the predominant assumptions that organized sports, especially soccer, represent social forms to maintain Mexican traditions alive in the U.S. and reproduce traditional hierarchies from the motherland. Instead, I argue, organized sports among Mexican communities are forming strong roots within a U.S. working class and leisure culture that emphasizes hard work, discipline, manhood, individuality, and competitiveness, and reflects both the shortcomings and aspirations of the Mexican experiences in the U.S. Moreover, Mexicans have envisioned soccer as a social space to initiate political participation, contest the dominant culture, defy urban segregation, disprove negative ethnic stereotypes, construct and display transnational ethnic loyalties, and celebrate a notion of Mexicanness or Mexicanidad based on the immigrant experience in the United States. Few scholars have focused on the social significance of organized sports among Latino communities in the U.S. The little research available focuses exclusively on baseball, football, and boxing. The new sports history, on the other hand, has just recently begun to explore the complex connections between race, ethnicity, immigration, nation building, and sports in urban settlements. Using oral history and archival and newspaper research, I closely follow the history of two different soccer associations in Chicago and Detroit from 1940 to 1970. Club Social y Deportivo México, founded in Detroit in 1958, and Club Deportivo Necaxa, active in Chicago in the 1940s and 1950s. So according to my research, soccer fields have emerged as crucial spaces where issues of ethnic identity, social organization, community awareness, cultural transmission, and transnational networks are thought out, displayed, negotiated, and enacted. This paper illustrates, then, the process by which Mexican soccer fields in urban Midwestern areas emerge as multidimensional border spaces where transnational and transborder social relationships are created, performed, and experienced. In these soccer fields, Mexicans and Mexican Americans adopt outdoor leisure activities and sport rituals prevalent in American cities, but at the same time, the soccer players, their families, relatives, and friends, along with the food vendors, the musicians, and the spectators, Mexicanize the urban landscape and manifest the right to have access to public facilities. In the 1940s, Mexican communities in the Great Lakes began to sponsor soccer teams in amateur leagues organized by European immigrants. Soccer, however, initially did not represent a challenge to baseball as a preferred collective sport for Mexican communities across the U.S. Numerous reasons explain the dominance of baseball and basketball in Mexican barrios in Chicago and Detroit. Basketball, football, and baseball counted with the full support from the school system, and especially from the Catholic Church social programs. Deeply ingrained with Americanization drives, both school and churches dismiss soccer as an activity of little social value. The central issue, however, was the fact that the majority of Mexicans in both the US and Mexico unquestionably preferred baseball over soccer prior to World War II, and therefore opted to play the former. In Midwestern communities, as Richard Santillan has recently pointed out, Mexicans overwhelmingly prefer baseball to any other sport, and consequently organize baseball games, clubs, and leagues of their own since the 1920s. Besides the Mexican National Baseball League started in 1925, 2 decades before the creation of a truly national and professional soccer league in Mexico. So how did soccer start in Mexico? British workers introduced soccer to Mexico in the late 19th century. White collar and skilled workers in the mining, textile, and other industries owned and managed by British companies inaugurated amateur leagues in central Mexico. And then elite Mexicans with educational or traveling experiences in Great Britain and Europe also decided to form soccer sport clubs in Mexico City and Guadalajara. In the 1920s and 1930s, clubs organized by Spanish immigrants, such as the Asturias, the España, and Aurrera, dominated the league and outnumbered the British clubs in Mexico. In the 1930s, soccer increased its popularity in urban areas, especially Mexico City, Guadalajara, Puebla, and León. While Spanish teams continued to dominate the league, Mexican teams sponsored by union workers, local factories, and state agencies began to challenge such supremacy. In Mexico City, 2 Mexican-based clubs emerged as the most popular among the lower classes. Atlante was the first one with the nickname of Los Morenitos, the Dark Ones, and Necaxa, founded in 1922 and run by electric power union workers. The working classes, who traditionally disliked the Spanish central professional teams, adopted Atlante and Necaxa as their own and strongly identified with their cause. Necaxa's electricistas, or electricians, gained considerable renown by conquering the league's title on various occasions in the 1930s, always against the Spanish teams. The symbolic victories achieved by Necaxa turned the club into the most popular in Mexico City, with support from government authorities in Lázaro Cárdenas' nationalist regime. In the 1940s, soccer made significant advances with increasing urbanization in central Mexico, Jalisco, and the Bajío area, but remained practically unfamiliar to the rest of the country. The Mexican government played a significant role in boosting Mexicans' participation by limiting the number of foreign players in each team. Besides, the Federación Mexicana de Fútbol, National Mexican Federation of Soccer, was entirely reorganized in 1943 with a complete professionalization of the sport and a very ambitious plan to expand soccer nationwide. So what I'm saying here, that prior to the consolidation of the Federación Mexicana de Fútbol in 1943, soccer's teams in Mexico were semi-professional, made up by Spanish immigrants and refugees, college students, and some state union workers, all geographically concentrated in the urban areas of western and central Mexico. Soccer emerged in the Midwestern Mexican barrios in the 1940s only as a marginal sport. The regional origins of Mexicans resident in Chicago and Detroit did not contribute to the sport expansion. Industrial centers in the Great Lakes attracted significant numbers of Mexican and Mexican-American workers from several locations, but especially from western Mexico and south Texas. Mexicanos with former residence and or origin in Texas certainly prefer baseball, as well as Mexican immigrants from the border states like Chihuahua, Sonora, Nuevo León, Coahuila, etc., where baseball had prevailed for decades. Immigrants from western Mexico, that is Jalisco, Michoacán, Guanajuato, and Zacatecas, came from rural communities where soccer was barely known or practiced. In fact, the best-known ethnographies of villages in Michoacán and Jalisco in that era fail to mention soccer completely. I mean, if you go and check out, you know, any ethnography about a village in the 1940s in Michoacán or in Jalisco, they don't mention soccer, right? And we all know that in the 1940s and 50s, every Michoacán village had, you know, an anthropologist from the U.S. Working there. They were part of the family, right? So there is no soccer there. So these areas, vital to the establishment of Midwestern barrios, it seems, have been largely unaffected by soccer's professional development and expansion. And yet, Mexican immigrants in the Great Lakes were not unfamiliar with soccer. Although rural communities in the 1930s and 1940s did not practice the sport in significant numbers, many immigrants became acquainted with soccer in different urban environments, especially Guadalajara, León, and Mexico City, before traveling to the United States. Manuel Correa, one of the people I had the honor to work with, founder of the Club Tajimaroa in Chicago, for instance, played soccer in the second division in Salvatierra, Guanajuato in the early 1950s while working in a factory, despite the fact that soccer was not popular or known in his native Ciudad Hidalgo in Michoacán. Juan Hernandez, a pioneer player in the Detroit's Club Mexico, was born in the United States but learned to play soccer in Guadalajara when he was a child while joining the Club Atlas Youth League. Consequently, soccer was introduced to the Mexican barrios in the Great Lakes by Mexicans with previous background in central and western industrial cities in Mexico. One of the first organized soccer associations in the area, I mean in Chicago, was the Club Necaxa. Here's a picture of the Club Necaxa. Necaxa was active since the late 1930s and in the 1940s participated in the Chicago National Soccer League. Created by European immigrants in 1919, the Chicago National League was and still is one of the strongest amateur leagues in the United States, with teams from several ethnic European communities. Necaxa's entry into this league certainly provided a strong symbol for the Mexican colonia to gather around. The selection of the team's name after the Necaxa from Mexico City, who in the 1930s battled against the Spaniard teams and the foreign teams in general in the Mexican League, indicates the aspiration to constitute an association attractive to all Mexicans in Chicago, and especially those with previous industrial and urban experiences. The Necaxa, in its Chicago version, would struggle against the European teams just as the prototype had campaigned in the previous decade in Mexico against the Spanish teams, and would gather support from industrial and urban workers of Mexican descent in Chicago. Now, this is very important. Unlike baseball in the area, where Mexican teams were excluded by both formal and subtle mechanisms from joining the regular leagues, soccer in the Chicago National League provided an opportunity for Mexicans to play against white ethnic teams under equal circumstances, to gain respect from their opponents, and to refute anti-Mexican stereotypes. Necaxa opened the opportunity to develop a healthy competition between Mexicans and ethnic Europeans, two groups who had been traditionally at odds in Chicago since the late 1910s. Created as a voluntary association, the Necaxa Club held a prominent position in shaping recreational and social activities for people of Mexican descent in Chicago. The local Spanish language newspaper and the Catholic newspaper based on St. Francis Parish in the city soon began covering the Necaxa's games and the club non-athletic increasing activities. The club very soon evolved into a community center with social and cultural activities. For instance, on Saturday, December the 2nd, 1946, the Club Deportivo Necaxa celebrated its annual Grandioso Baile. Let me show you the ad, just in case you're interested. It's, you know, Grandioso Baile in el West End Women's Club, right? Sábado 2 de diciembre, dedicado al equipo de fútbol Necaxa, right? Dedicated to the football team Necaxa. Ball dances organized to raise funds for the club were not the only social activities. In the following days, on December 15, 1946, the club Necaxa organized its first posada, a Mexican traditional celebration for Christmas. The 1946 posada organized by the Necaxa club combined Mexican traditions with modern life, music, dancing, raffles, prizes, and pleasant surprises, I quote, and pleasant surprises for everybody, including piñatas and candies for children. Besides, the Necaxa participated in traditional Mexican parades and festivities in Chicago with its soccer queens. Mm-hmm. Necaxa Club's activities also transcended the boundaries of Sunday and weekends. A pamphlet printed by the club in the 1940s allows us to explore the wide variety of social activities organized by this soccer association on a regular basis. On Monday, for instance, they provided English as second language classes to its members. On Thursday nights, the club had the screening of interesting movies and dancing. On Sunday afternoons, after the soccer game, social gathering also and dancing. The long list of sponsors and advertisers present in the pamphlet illustrates the immediate recognition and financial support that the Necaxa obtained from the increasing number of ethnic Mexican-oriented businesses. Let me show you this. So this is some of the ads that appear in the Necaxa's pamphlet, right? Advertisers and sponsors included 10 restaurants, grocery stores and meat markets, 8 bars and liquor stores, 6 record store businesses, Spanish language programs in radio, 2 tailor shops, 2 printing houses, 1 automobile workshop, 1 shoe repair store, 1 pharmacy, and even 1 funeral home. As the Necaxa program illustrates, Mexican soccer teams in Midwestern urban environments could become centers for social activities that extended beyond the boundaries of sports competition. In close connection to the interests of a rising ethnic market and the growing purchase power of Mexican workers in Chicago, Mexican soccer teams became a golden window to establish ties among Mexicans as consumers. Necaxa Club also supplied an outlet to Spanish broadcasting radio programs to advertise musical shows. Through the radio programming in Spanish, Mexicans could have access to Mexican and Latin American music. And those new consumer tastes combined Mexican products and practices with efficient and modern American standards. No less important were the Necaxa the NECAXA's efforts to teach English as a second language regularly and to structure a recreational and social life for urban laborers after work. Such activities intended to familiarize Mexicans with a new industrial environment and to facilitate their assimilation into American standards of leisure and participation in voluntary associations. The club activities clearly reflect a decision to articulate a social life for Mexicans in Chicago on a permanent basis while cultivating Mexican cultural features more in accordance with the American urban environment. The Club NECAXA's range of social activities illustrates the ways in which Mexican workers in Chicago responded to various influences, a rising ethnic market that combined Mexican culture with American consumption patterns, an increasing need to create leisure and recreational spaces for an emerging working class community, a growing desire to adjust to American standards of living, and a profound aspiration to find forms to represent the Mexican experience in Chicago as successful and prosperous. NECAXA was then a source of ethnic pride and a self-made image of the Mexican community in Chicago that conveyed a message of athletic accomplishments, national identification, and hardworking values. NECAXA represented Mexicans in Chicago in a national arena as yet another immigrant group with a thriving experience and a positive contribution. I'll show you the next. This is also from the pamphlet. As Mexicans in Chicago entered the urban and industrial labor force in large numbers in the 1940s, their discretionary time and budget expanded considerably. In her 1928 dissertation on social conditions prevalent in Mexican neighborhoods in Chicago, Anita Jones noticed an increasing need for organized recreational activities. Soccer teams not only provided a response to such new social expectations, but also a chance to portray the Mexican community in positive terms, to recreate national symbols, and to foster a consumer culture oriented to Mexican food, Mexican music, and Mexican movies. In the pamphlet's closing statement, that's this one, the club's board of directors emphasized the identification of NECAXA with the Latin American community's hopes and aspirations. And it says in Spanish, el Club NECAXA agradece la cooperación de la colonia, blah, blah, blah. I'm going to give you the translation, right? NECAXA Sports Club respectfully thanks the support provided by the Latin American community to its soccer football team and to its club in general in all the activities in the present year. NECAXA Sports Club hopes that Latin Americans continue to help and motivate the team in the future to always keep in high regard the name of our club and the pride of our race. In Detroit, the Colonia Mexicana started to organize soccer clubs in a process very similar to that of the NECAXA Club. The Detroit Soccer League, a predominantly European immigrant organization, had a team named Hispanos Unidos, who was run by Spanish nationals since 1922, but allowed players from Latin America. In the 1950s, some of the Mexican players decided to split and create their own national team, and in 1958, they created the Club Social y Deportivo México under the management of Salvador Rojas and Román Pérez. This is the first picture of the Club Social y Deportivo México in Detroit. The core of the group worked at the Ford plant and or the Great Lakes Steel Corporation. Club Mexico soon became an important social center for the Mexican colony in Southwest Detroit. Club Mexico wore a uniform identical to the Club Guadalajara, the most popular soccer team in Mexico since the 1950s, due to its winning record and its nationalist features. The Club Guadalajara in Mexico didn't allow and still doesn't allow foreign players in its lineup, right? In Detroit, they decided to have the same uniform as the Club Guadalajara because of that reason. Sure. This is the second picture of the Club Mexico. as in the case of the Chicago's Necaxa, the adoption of Guadalajara's uniform in Detroit represented an important source of ethnic affirmation for Detroit Mexicans, and in particular for those born in Jalisco. The Club Mexico combined, in its choices of name and uniform, its aspirations to represent all Mexicans in Detroit. Club Mexico's games at Patton Park soon became permanent gathering spaces for Mexican families and central events around which to structure and organize Sunday activities. As Alex Rojas, Salvador Rojas' son, one of the founders, remembers, every Sunday, players and their families attended Mass and went together to Patton Park for the soccer match. While the game was on, families organized picnics, games for children, and other recreational activities. For Mexicans in the urban Midwest, Sunday games became social events where the athletic competition was merely one of many meaningful events. Club Mexico also registered as an official organization with formal elections, statutes, and regular membership. And soon the Club Mexico organizers also envisioned having a physical base, and in 1960 they rented a hall to host social gatherings on weekdays where diverse activities took place after work, raffles, dances, domino games, and other game boards, etc. Following the Necaxa's path, Detroit's Club Mexico provided an opportunity to access recreational facilities, enter a voluntary association, structure a social life after work, reaffirm Mexican culture, and recreate Mexican traditions in combination with American values. Through voluntary sports associations, Mexicans and Mexican Americans in Chicago and Detroit created a social space to renew their Mexican traditions and facilitate adjustment to life in the Great Lakes. Inter-ethnic athletic competition for these communities provided an opportunity to disprove negative stereotypes and instead portray the Mexican presence in the Midwest as a success story. In that sense, and this is one of my findings, in that sense, Mexican soccer clubs mirror an experience in social organization similar to that of ethnic European sports clubs, and not similar to what organized sports were in Mexico. The participation of Mexican soccer clubs in ethnic European soccer leagues also provided the possibility of gaining visibility and respect from the outside community and securing access to otherwise limited outdoor recreational facilities. The non-athletic achievements of Mexican clubs in Chicago and Detroit are, however, considerably more important than the sport victories gained within the field boundaries. Both the Club Mexico and the Club Necaxa became authentic community centers for Mexican families in the urban landscape and responded to their aspiration to articulate a commitment to reside permanently in the United States. These voluntary organizations functioned as well as social spaces to identify and develop leadership and political skills. Salvador Rojas, for instance, the president of the Club Mexico in the 1960s, was elected too as president of the Comité Patriótico Mexicano in Detroit for 6 consecutive years. And I'm going to show you some of the slides here. Okay, this is the Club Mexico in Detroit in 1958. This is the first picture. And then it's the Club Mexico in the 60s now with the t-shirt from the Guadalajara Club in Mexico. Now this is the color era, right? Now they have, you know, the rayas in red and white. Here we have another picture of the Club Mexico, this time around wearing the national colors of the Mexican national team. This is another picture. And this is two of the most recent soccer clubs in Detroit, the Club Jalisco and the Club Olympia before the final game. And now this is a team from the year 2001. These are the Pumas from Detroit too. But this is what I want you to focus on, how the soccer field becomes a social center, not only for players, but also for children, families, women, and vendors, right? We have here, you know, a picture of the kids in playing with the goal. Here's another picture, and this is one of the pictures that are in the exhibit, right? I apologize, it's not a good picture. This is yet another picture of children trying to emulate adult soccer players, right? And also the idea of becoming a man by being a father, a good father, right? There is a very important element among soccer organizers and players in which they have to bring, you know, their children. They have to show their children how good of a father they are. This is another picture. I like this picture because this woman and her child, they don't have a relative playing in the soccer field, right? They go to the soccer field because of the social value that it has for Mexicans in Southwest Detroit, right? They don't even care about the soccer match, right? And there is another example of how soccer, you know, organizes and creates, you know, regional identity. This is a match between the Mexican selection of Chicago against the Mexican selection of Detroit, right? And I like this picture very much because you have, you know, Mexicans in Chicago that are playing, you know, on behalf of the city of Chicago that against, you know, Mexicans who are playing on behalf of the city of Detroit. And this is a guy who, you know, sells ice cream, Mexican ice cream, you know, paletas. He wanted the picture and we took it, of course. And this is another example of how, you know, family and especially women go to the soccer field without really showing any care for what's going on inside the soccer field. And this is my favorite guy. You know, he goes there and he sells Mexican cowboy boots, right? That's his deal, and we took this picture of him because he wanted to appear, you know, as it is. And I like the picture because he's turning his back on the soccer field, right? I mean, the soccer field just the background, right? Okay, that's enough. Okay. Center not only on the athletic performance of its players, but more importantly on the family and communal activities before, during, and after the soccer game, soccer clubs generated a sense of a place for adults, men, women, youth, and children in which each subgroup could socialize in their own terms. For the non-playing attendance, the athletic performance and game's outcome were practically irrelevant compared with the opportunity to socialize and establish networks with other families, other children, and other women. Far from undergoing a process of, I quote, aborted assimilation, as it has been suggested, Mexican communities in Chicago and the Great Lakes turned their baseball, soccer, and other sports voluntary associations into new venues to claim access to urban spaces and create social areas upon which a sense of community and shared experience could be developed and consolidated. As Richard Santillan has pointed out for Mexican baseball teams in the Midwest, sport events contained important elements of political empowerment, cultural unity, and community identity. The history of Necaxa and Club Mexico organizations in the Great Lakes corroborates these findings and also stresses the various ways in which Mexican teams became vehicles for social adaptation, especially in the shaping of voluntary association, the incorporation of working class values, and the creation of leisure and recreational activities. And last but not least, the acceptance of an emerging consumer culture based on the blending of Mexican traditions and American values. As George Sanchez has demonstrated in his study on Mexican immigrants in Los Angeles, Mexicanos reshape their native traditions in a complex process of cultural adaptation and negotiation with the challenges posed by their new environment and their expectations to form a permanent life in the United States. Vicky Ruiz's analysis of the social interactions Mexican women engage with Americanization projects in El Paso, and Arizona, elucidates as well the emergence of an intense process of what she calls cultural coalescence. In this process, Mexicans responded by creating new social spaces to address their particular needs and affirm their ethnic culture. The history of Mexican soccer clubs in the Great Lakes provides another example of such interactions and the creative ways in which Mexican communities have reshaped and generated their sports and recreational traditions to build a better life in the United States. And that's it.
I think Dr. Pescador will take some questions or reactions.
We have the lights.
Yes.
Yes?
If they originally, the workers originally were in the Ford factory and in Great Lakes Steel, mm-hmm. where are they working today? That is, the new soccer players. Is there any kind of string, historical string, in terms of either continuing with identification with the Rouge or with the other factories, or have they become, in some cases, Mexican-American middle class individuals who are still playing soccer, who are now the children of original Ford mm-hmm. workers, mm-hmm. and so forth?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I decided to end my talk in 1970 because after that it becomes really complicated. It becomes very complex. One of the things that those players, or the majority of those players now, they are team organizers. Mm-hmm. And now Detroit has a huge Mexican league, right? Many of these players have become organizers of their own, and they have also become community leaders. Soccer has become a social venue for them to be identified as leaders and then to voice, you know, the community's needs. Mm-hmm. So in some cases, the players became team managers. Mm-hmm. In other cases, one of the founders retired to South Texas, and now he has a baseball team there, right? Which proves my point that sports are a social venue to facilitate adaptation and to create an ethnic pride, right? To foster an ethnic identity that not necessarily is being held otherwise. But in short, some of the organizers now still work for the Great Lakes Steel Corporation, but that is not the general rule.
Two questions. I wanted to ask a little bit about, you described this is a Great Lakes phenomenon, and you're looking at Detroit and Chicago, and I know with Latino baseball leagues that they were in other cities too in this area, and I know it's quite a different phenomenon, but with soccer, are you aware, are there clubs in Cleveland or in other major cities at mm-hmm. all? Are you picking up on that with your research?
Well, we took the exhibit, the photo exhibit, to Albion College, and then when we presented the exhibit, there was a group of soccer players there, and they are from Jackson, and actually they, for what I've been told, they have gone through the same process, right? And they wanted us to, you know, to go there and take pictures of them because of that reason, because of the visibility that soccer gives to people, right? To communities, right? Let's not forget that if you go to Patton Park in Detroit, there is no swimming pool, there is no public restrooms, there is no picnic tables. I mean, this is called a park, I don't know for what reason, because it doesn't have any facilities. And it is the league who provides everything, right? So they are expressing the right to have access to public facilities by playing soccer too.
Another just kind of follow-up question in comparing the baseball situation is that I know with Latino baseball, one of the things that helped mobilize and encourage the expansion to create leagues, moving from a team in each city, was the appearance of touring teams from Mexico, baseball teams. Mm-hmm. Are you aware, was there ever a team from Guadalajara, one of those teams, or a team that ever came to Chicago mm-hmm. or had an exhibition game or something mm-hmm. like that?
No, in fact, well, because of the large influence of people from Western Mexico in Detroit, mm-hmm. there is a town that one student of mine and myself are working on, San Ignacio, that has more than 5,000 people in Detroit. And they organize a soccer team once a year in San Ignacio, where the Mexicans from Detroit play against the Mexicans from San Ignacio, right? And this is incredible because soccer has become, in the 1990s, a vehicle for the building of transnational communities. And the Mexican state, the Mexican government has already, you know, realized of that. And they organize, they have what they call the Copa Mexico. It's a national tournament that takes place only in the United States for people of Mexican descent in the United States. And they don't allow foreign players, right? I don't know if this is even legal, right? But that's how that's how important soccer is as a community activity. Even now, even the Mexican government, you know, wants to sponsor soccer tournaments, right?
I'll take the risk of just one quick question. Sure. About the photograph. I wanted you to comment on the photograph of the team from Detroit and Chicago. You didn't mention the two women who were dressed and with flowers. What was their role?
Well, they are what they call soccer queens, right? But the role of women is so complex and so important that it needs to be studied, you know, separately. In fact, Luz Maria Gordillo, my student, she's doing her dissertation only on the role of women in Detroit in these social events, because women don't play. I mean, soccer is a border zone also between men and women. In Chicago, in the youth league, women are already playing, right? But in Detroit, in the majority of teams, women do not play, and still they go there, right? And of course, they go there not to see the game, right? And they go there not to show, you know, support or anything. They go there to build other kind of networks and to establish other kind of social relationships, especially among women, right? Yes.
My question is, you compare the, you know, the formation of these Mexican soccer leagues to other European immigrants.
Right.
How about comparison to what's going on in Mexico?
But that's the whole thing. I mean, if you go to Mexico and try to find out a club that is teaching English as a second language to its members, that is celebrating Mexican posadas, that is, you know, trying to create a national identity based on athletic performance, you're not going to find it, right? Because those kind of teams were born in Detroit and in Chicago as a response to the situation that Mexicans were facing in the 1940s, 1950s. They couldn't play baseball against the white teams because of subtle or formal discriminatory practices, but they realized they could play soccer against the same kind of European teams or European-oriented teams, and they took full advantage of that opportunity, and that's, you know, the venue to show that Mexicans can also play any sport, right? Because, like I said, soccer is not popular in these communities in Western Mexico. In these places, if you go there in the 1940s, as many U.S. anthropologists did, nobody's playing soccer, right? There are other sports. There is baseball to some extent. There is basketball too. There is, you know, charrería, but there is no soccer, right? Soccer is always attached to the increasing urbanization and industrialization of places, right? So soccer starts in Mexico as an industrial sport when Mexico becomes an industrial country, right? That's in the 40s and 50s in Mexico City, Guadalajara, and that's it. But other than that, no, right? And the ultimate proof that they didn't play soccer in Mexico is that in the first seasons they lost all the games, right? Right? And they learned to play soccer here as an organized sport. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that in the backyard of their houses they didn't play soccer. I don't know that for a fact. But as an organized sport, they created soccer clubs here first and then back in their communities of origin. Yes?
One thing that you mentioned was the issue of space. And this would seem to me to be an area where you could look at contestation over space issues, say in the Detroit parks, because baseball was already an accepted American sport,
right,
as was basketball.
Right.
But the idea of actually using the city of Detroit or anyone else's funds to build soccer fields
right.
within a park, that very well may have led, not unlike, as you raised, the issue of discrimination about Mexican workers in baseball leagues or plain American baseball players in Detroit. What about the issue of contestation over whether or not soccer fields would even be built in Detroit parks, for example?
Right.
Is there any evidence of that?
I think you're right. I mean, they are expressing, you know, the right to have access to public facilities and the right to Mexicanize the landscape, right? To Mexicanize the Sunday. I mean, because Detroit is Mexican. Well, you like it or not, Mexicans have been living there since the 1910s or even before. So they are expressing that kind of political statement, right? I mean, soccer is we want to play soccer. We don't like baseball, right? And we're going to do it, right? And one of the largest leagues now, amateur leagues, is the Mexican League in Chicago, the Chicago Latin American Soccer Association. It has thousands of members, right? So what's going on with soccer is the same process that is going on with the Catholic Church, right? Now the Catholic Church is Mexicanizing, you know, the altars, is welcoming Mexican devotions, mm-hmm. is sponsoring masses in Spanish, you know, is recognizing the Mexican presence inside the churches, right?
But I guess what I'm really asking, to follow up, mm-hmm. do we have, for example, a trajectory anywhere within the literature, within the historical record, that looks at how many soccer fields are available in Detroit, say in 1925, versus how many are available in Detroit, looked at being able to track things like worker holidays based on train schedules,
right.
based on other kinds of things. It would seem to me that looking at how space has been contested would be possible by
right.
looking at
right.
city council yeah. records.
That's a great idea, you know, how the landscape has been, you know, transformed by these soccer clubs. That's a great idea. Yeah, follow up on that.
Two questions that sort of get at the same underlying concept, I think. The first one is, other than the Mexican government recognizing that they should sponsor these teams, when the Mexican communities began developing soccer, was this a conscious thing, saying we need to have a way or a place or a venue or a way for people to get together and we like soccer so we'll do it this way, or did it just sort of evolve and has become an important social piece? That's one part of the question. Mm-hmm. On the other side of things, from your research perspective, was your work primarily observational, or did you talk with the players and the children and the mothers to get their comments, testimonials about what that meant?
Mm-hmm. No, we talked to everybody. We interviewed, I interviewed a lot of players in Chicago, in Douglas Park, and also in Lincoln Park, and in Detroit, of course.
But more than the players?
More than the players, you know, the spectators. Why do you come here? What is so attractive about coming here? You know, why you don't pay attention to the game? Or who was the last, you know, year champion, for instance, right? They don't know. It's like, who cares? And following the first question, yes, it was intentional. I mean, the very nature of the names and the color of the uniforms indicate this idea, this need, this craving to have a Mexican national symbol, right? I mean, it's not accidental. They wanted to do so because they sort of had a sense of what it could mean, you know, if it's if it went on, right? And you know, now, like I said, the Mexican League in Detroit has more than 600 players registered, right? The Chicago Latin American Soccer Association has thousands, right? Yes?
When you say they haven't registered, did they register with the United States Soccer Federation?
Right.
Okay. But I do have to tell you, when you're talking about fields, it's not just the Mexican players who need fields. All across
right.
the country, fields are needed. I serve on the United States Soccer Foundation, and I came here today. Well, I lived here recently, but I came because I wanted, when I saw the thing in the paper, I thought, well, this is very interesting. And I know that the Federation and the Foundation keep pushing for more fields and getting inner city involved. And again, we give out $2 million a year in grants to projects for soccer because we know that they will have social value. But a lot of times, and you keep talking about the men playing.
Right.
Are they trying, and when you say, oh, 600 people are registered, that is not a lot of people for as many players as could be in that community.
Right.
And are they trying to help the children play? When you showed kids in uniform, I assumed that the kids were in uniform because they were playing on different teams.
Yeah. No, they were in uniform because they were dressed in uniform to be taken to the soccer field. But one of the ideas now in Detroit is to have a youth league, right?
Well, because there is the Detroit Soccer League, but again, we have given money to the United States Soccer Foundation, plus also the Michigan Foundation, and all this money came from World Cup when it was here in 94,
mm-hmm.
and we are primarily trying to reach youth so that they can go ahead and then through their lives be playing. But I'm a little disappointed that the men up here that are playing, and it keeps being the men that are playing, that they haven't gone down and mm-hmm. created them, or maybe they have.
They have already started, to thinking along those lines. The Mundo Latino League in Detroit is only 5 years old, right? But now they are thinking about building a teams for children and having a youth league. But in Chicago, the Chicago Latin American Soccer Association has had a teams for children since I don't know how many
years. So right. I was gonna say, because I know that, and so, okay, but again, as far as fields go, I don't think anybody's trying to keep people from having fields in the community, but all communities are facing a lot of problems and trying to get land to be able to build soccer specific.
Right.
Yes.
Did you find any ethnic conflicts after games or during games or about this space that they're contesting?
Well, this.
Another European.
No, but that's part of the game. That's part of the game. That's one of the reasons why people play soccer, because you can confront within certain boundaries different groups, right? And with time you become friends with your rivals, right? But that's part of the game, to show a certain degree of competitiveness or manhood or willingness to defeat the other, right?
Because they were playing their fellow workers in the same factory.
Right.
What about sports sponsorship? I guess, again, going back to your studies, really, and my study, my question about contestation was really about the 40s rather than today,
mm-hmm.
about fields. But my assumption is that, say, you've got a group from Great Lakes Steel. Are they asking Great Lakes, or are they asking the steel workers, for example, for sponsorship of the teams? So in effect, there is much more wrapping in a Mexican-American identity,
right.
Mexican identity, rather than the kind of sports branding that we would get,
right.
UAW Local 137
right.
or whatever. Does that still continue historically from the 40s forward?
Yeah,
so today's sponsorship is not from...
It's not from the big corporations. They don't want sponsorship from the big corporations. They want sponsorship from the Mexican restaurants, from the Mexican taquerias, from the Mexican clubs, from the Mexican music record stores, because it's a source of ethnic identity. And the Mexican taquerias want to sponsor the teams because of the visibility that it gets. Any other question?
Javier, just really quickly, I missed at the very beginning what you were saying about how your findings differed from traditional interpretation of the role of sport in Latin American communities.
Right, because in general, the current literature sort of assumes that soccer in the U.S. is a Mexican tradition. That is, that Mexicans, came with tacos and soccer, and they decided to play soccer because they don't know anything else. And it is not true. I mean, historically, it is completely inaccurate, right?
Please join me in thanking Dr. Pesenberg.
Thank you.